You ever have people on that when you hear their name, it takes you back to your childhood, and all you think about is the coyote and the runner? Mr. Wiley McGraw is here. This guy is a bad dude. I'm not gonna lie. Your beard screams special forces, but your body does not. It's like you've got everything it takes to be an SF dude. I wonder why. And then you've got this other really creative, entrepreneurial leader, public figure, acceleration into life. And it is something that I'm really grateful to be able to bring to our listeners because you work with such interesting human beings. You are such a hu interesting human being, but you don't rest on your laurels as to what you used to do. You act completely different than what I expected when I found out who you were. I had no idea you had prior service when I booked you on the show. And I know people are like, Kelsey, you should know your guests before you book them. But I wasn't attracted to that. I was very, very, very curious about your radical performance acceleration program. I was super intrigued by the fact that you rode bulls and you still have a brain that's functioning. I just wanted to talk to you about so many different topics that I know our listeners are going to get a huge amount of lessons from. So thanks for being on the show, Wiley.
Kelsey, that was a phenomenal way to introduce me. Thank you so much for having me, though. I'm looking forward to this conversation for a little while.
Yeah, absolutely, man. As soon as I heard your name, I was like, Wiley Coyote.
That's right.
I just went into like my childhood and it made me smile. So I was like, what a great way to start a friendship and a relationship. And I'm really fascinated by you, man. You've been on a lot of the same shows. You sat down with Andy Stumpf, one of my favorite humans, arguably one of the most funny, sarcastic dudes I've ever known. And your conversation was so fluid and so easy. And I was like, this guy needs to be pried a little bit more into some of these things and the emotional components to it. So let's get right into it, man. How did you become the human that you are today?
Holy mackerel, you want to dive that deep already? All right, I love
Oh,
it.
yeah.
Yeah, I figured that's where you were going to go, but I got to tell you, it's interesting as I kind of came into this world. It's like I already was battling people's demons right out of the womb. So but I didn't understand that until I got older, until I got into, especially got to the military world, when I started to realize, okay, there was something a little bit different or unique about me based on how people were interacting with me, the kind of experiences I was having. I used to think, is something wrong with me? Is it me? Is it my personality? Do people not like me? Am I just not material enough to make everybody happy? So I grew up in this household of athletes. My dad being an athlete. I was first born of three boys in Southern California, and my dad threw me right into baseball. Saw the talent, started to mold me into this what he expected me, this potential professional athlete. So I grew up around that my entire life. I grew up around pro athletes. I was trained by the California Angels pitching staff in the 80s as a young pitcher. I thought that would be my career path. And but the family dynamics were also chaotic as well. I grew up in a Irish Scottish household, immigrants from Ireland and Scotland, devout Catholic, completely just stoic, and there's narcissism. There's all sorts of different types of high functioning, addictive personalities, people that are very successful in the entrepreneurial world, the medical field, et cetera, but also don't like to deal with their own demons, if you will. So as a this different type of kid, I was always experiencing people dumping their trash on me. It's constantly battling people, utilizing me as that space for their place to truly erupt and really start to confront those darker parts of themselves, without realizing that's what I was doing. So for me, I took that with me. And as I got older into high school, I was like, I want something different. This is starting to make me feel a little like funky about everything. I feel like I'm doing all of this for the sake of what I'm expected to do, or my dad, what he wants from me, or my family, what they think I should be. So I literally started to rebel and break away from that mold. And I got introduced to a pro rodeo cowboy through a friend of mine in high school, and fell in love with the seductive draw of that wild, crazy world. Decided to get on the back of a bull for the first time at 16 years old. And when I hit the ground and that bull fell on top of me, I got that Charlie horse, that rush of energy through me. It turned me on. It was like a whole new world of excitement, of pain and thrill and being emotionally present. And I just said, I want this more than anything. So I started to pursue bull riding, and just turned me into this different version of myself that had been, I would say, hidden behind the more emotionally sensitive, artistic, creative kid that I was, athlete, and into this more rugged nature of Wiley that I really wanted to meet, that I felt wasn't being accentuated through my relationships and my family. And bull riding turned me onto a whole new world of life. It gave me an insight to what fear is, how to yield to it, how to use it as an asset for your growth. What the unknowns will do for you if you surrender to them, realizing that if I try to be rigid in that world, I get hurt. And if I let go and be fluid, I actually ride much better. I can perform at a different level. And that really instilled this whole new perspective of what life could be for me. And that's why I started to pursue more opportunities that were even more challenging, which was the military was the next step for me. And on top of that, I have a legacy military family, Kelsey. So every man in my family served since World War II, but it wasn't a, you have to do it. It was just there. My grandfathers were D-Day vets, Bronze Star recipients. My uncles were MACV SOG in Vietnam. My stepdad was Desert Storm. My dad was a Vietnam corpsman. So everybody served. And then I got to the point where as I was competitively bull riding in high school, playing sports, I went to a junior Marine Corps program, fell in love with the structure of the military and said, you know what? I want to get out of here. I want something a little bit more exciting and more challenging for me. And that's when I went to the United States Army recruiter. It's like, hey, I'm ready to leave. Put me into a position where I can really be stretched and pushed. And joined the Army and did some really cool stuff for about 5.5 years active duty with light infantry with 101st Airborne Division, 3 tours overseas. And through that process, going to war, seeing the death and destruction that it brings, losing friends, being involved in gunfights and things like that really woke me up to the pain in the world and understanding how human beings live their lives and why we have such conflict. And as I got out of the military, I started to pursue that path of self-mastery, if you will, getting a self-regulation, learning about how to live without the demons that plague us, how that affects performance, why people are missing the mark when it comes to personal development, and started to see the blind spots and the gaps in psychiatry and psychology, started to challenge the doctors at the VA. And I built my business working with veterans first and let it grow naturally from there based on who I was in this spiritual gift of mind to erupt and poke at and fight those demons and those unresolved stresses that people carry. So that's me in a long story, short form nutshell for you, Kelsey. I hope that helps.
Yeah, that's perfect. So we could just end there. That's great. Everybody enjoy that. That's fantastic. That's the shortest podcast Brass and Unity's ever had.
There you go.
Let's go all the way back. I got a lot of questions. I got a lot of different ideas. So the first thing you said, it brought me right ahead to intergenerational trauma. So sounds like how could you not, having a long list of very hard dudes in your family, bringing that intergenerational trauma baked into what would end up being you as a child. There wasn't a, like you said, a force to go in the military, but there was, it sounds like from the outside, there was this unknown, very quiet, unsaid, spoken responsibility. But prior to service, what was that? Hold on, I hear a blender. We're gonna hold.
No worries.
Okay,
did it stop? Oh, it stopped. Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that. It's like a noise. That's weird. Okay, good.
All good. So when we're talking about this and talking about your past and bull riding, I want to get into this a little bit because you're in California. That doesn't really seem like a route to go. I mean, from what I've tracked, you lived in an area that motocross and supercross was very prevalent. A lot of the teams live, a lot of the tracks are. So the fact that you went to bull riding seems a little foreign, but I want to understand how a young child decides to go get on this how many thousand pound animal that is designed to destroy you. And your parents went, we're good with that.
My parents didn't do that. That's the thing is I had literally conflict in the house because of that decision. So I'm glad that you even asking that question. Nobody's ever actually asked me that question. I've had to try to pepper it into conversation. So Kelsey, thank you. But my dad hated it. So my dad was pissed. And again, this is not a bad dashing session, okay? Because it's not, but my dad did not like it at all. He thought I was on a path to be a pro baseball player. My dad had sacrificed and given so much of his time, energy, his connections to introduce me to people he knew from his semi-pro career, right? I mean, I grew up around guys like Bo Jackson and Rod Carew from the Angels. I you know, JT Snow from the Angels, all those guys that really were big time dudes in the 80s, the popular pro athletes, my dad knew personally. So I think he started to realize that I was no longer in his mold anymore. I was no longer willing to be the thing. Again, being the firstborn son, I'm kind of an extension of him. So it was like, I'm going to do my own thing. And that created conflict. So I actually learned how to manage stress and conflict with my dad while simultaneously pursuing something that I felt very passionate about. And I think that really, it didn't break me, but it really forced me to come to terms with how living a life of passion and desire comes with discomfort, and it's not going to be easy. And being able to come home every day and fighting with my dad, and my dad would lock up my clothes, my cowboy hats, my bull riding gear, all my stuff in his car. I kicked his door in one time to get it out of his room because I was so pissed. I was like, you know what? This is my stuff that I paid with my own money. I ran my own little small business over the summer during high school where I was window washing and car washing the neighborhood, the houses and stuff to make a little money for myself. So pocket change, that was my money. That was my time, my investment. So it was the battle that I had to face with my dad to confront him every single day, doing it despite his disappointment in me with doing it, realizing that this is something that Wiley wanted. And that gave birth to a whole new understanding of you can pursue great things and you can have what you really desire if you're willing to embrace the discomforts that come with people and their expectations of you or their limitations that they try to place on you because of what they think might be best for you. And then going back to Lee's point, I think you said was generational trauma. Yeah, I think that's the biggest key here is people don't stop and say it, the buck stops with me. You know, people allow generational trauma to persist and be passed down along through generational lines, bloodlines, et cetera. And they think, well, that was my grandfather's problem. It ain't going to affect me. But the truth is it does. Mm-hmm. The only difference is that you tend to not see the blind spots in the dynamics themselves in those relationships. And you tend to chalk it up to just being normal. Oh yeah, my quirky dad or quirky aunt or the people that act this way, that's just them. That's who they are. They've got their own problems. I'm not going to let it affect me. And the reality is we're all interconnected. There's going to be an effect based on those dynamics. So all of that combined allowed me to start to grow intellectually, emotionally, and see, okay, these are the dynamics that affect people's ability to truly achieve and have what they want. How do we combat that, fight that head on, kill those demons, if you will, and actually pursue in that space of excellence that we are longing for without letting that hinder our capacity or our performance capabilities. And that's really what it gave me.
Well, that's really amazing that you were able to see that at a young age rather than fight against it and rebel against it, because that could have turned really negative very fast. And with intergenerational trauma like that, especially when you've got people with an immigrant family, I see it really, I see it very often when I'm having people on the show. When I ask them, like, where's your family from? Where are you from? And I have a similar background with the Irish and the Scottish immigrants coming over. And you see that when they come to countries like Canada and the United States. I mean, there's so many more children, the money spreads so thin, and you start to see the behaviors that they lived, which was scarcity mindset, living in a fear. And they come through the parents and they come down to the children, and you don't catch on to it till much later in life, at least I did. And so the fact that you were able to catch that at a young age and able to see it for what it is and kind of mold it to work for you rather than against you is what I would consider way more self-aware. And I don't know if that was because you were the oldest and it was like baked into you or how that worked, but I'm curious.
It's almost twofold. I think I wasn't as 100% self-aware as I would say today that I am of that situation. But at the same time, it's almost like a curiosity was constantly being stimulated every single day where I would have those self-talk conversations when I was alone in my room doing some drawing or listening to my Metallica records or whatever it was, you know, when I wasn't playing a sport. And going, why am I experiencing this? Having at least enough wherewithal to ask that question. Why do I feel like this with my father or my brothers or my family? Why is this happening to me right now? I didn't have the answers, but the question still allowed enough of that seed to grow steadily through me throughout high school to understand who I was as a young man. Like, what do I really want for myself? It didn't afford me the opportunity to pick and choose the friends I had or I grew up with. I was kind of like an anomaly in my high school. You know, I could hang out with any crew of people just because I just never fit in anywhere. So it gave me a good, I would say, foundation of self-awareness that I could build from. And being in those environments like bull riding around pro cowboys and eventually getting into the military, that really accelerated that level of self-awareness. So I think it was like that twofold where I was forced to be the leader of the brothers as the oldest. My dad expected more of me.
And brought to you by Mindful Meds. You guys have been seeing me take Mindful Meds for a little while now. Mindful Meds is a premium supplement company dedicated to supplying humans with the tools to improve their mental health, clarity, and performance, all while supporting their growth along the way. Whether it's the Immunity Blend, Lion's Mane, Inspire, or Voyage, all of their products are clean, tested, consistent, and they've become a huge help in my life. I found Mindful Meds over a year ago now, and I've never looked back. Go check out their website, mindfulmeds.io, and use the code BRASS at checkout.
So I was, again, being a pitcher in baseball, I was a leader on the team. So I had to learn at a young age how to lead a team, how to be confident on the mound and get the guys motivated, even though I was nervous about that. And at the same time, I had to be able to do that with my family and then also with myself. So it just became this, how do I compartmentalize myself enough where I can discipline each element of my leadership where I'm supposed to be as this guy, this Wiley McGraw, in my family and in my school and in the work that I do. I feel like that gave me a good, at least good roadmap to where I can actually evolve into the kind of guy that I am today.
The way that you just spoke there, you said something that I want to touch on. You said, how did you word it? You're like, it was happening to me, but really, it sounds like a lot of it was happening for you.
Oh,
And so,
100%.
and that
100%.
mentality and that shift and that ability to have that self-awareness shows you from a very young age that the leadership skills were baked in. That's one of the benefits of having some of those types of people passed down is there are traits that do get baked in naturally. So let's talk about baseball a little bit because baseball is one of those sports where you're either all in and you're good, or you're one of those like, well, I'll do baseball in the summer and like an activity for you to do, which is fine. I don't have an issue, but I want to talk about it because pitching in particular, I grew up with a kid that was a fighter at the same time. And there was a point where he had to make a decision if he was going to continue fighting or go into pitching. And I know he's a crazy, I don't know baseball very well, but I know he's crazy high up in it now. But pitching in itself has turned into, it's a completely different, I don't even say it's a completely different sport than baseball, but because it's the integral part of baseball, but pitching feels very different. It doesn't feel the same as if you're an outfielder versus an infielder. Pitching is a completely different ball game. It is the whole team is relying on you all of the time when you guys are in the outfield. So how do you handle pressure like that at a young age? And not only that, how do you manage shoulder and elbow injuries to keep yourself at a high enough
Ooh,
level?
those are phenomenal questions because there is a lot of pressure being on the mound and being the starting pitcher for the teams that you get picked to be on. It's truly having mentors and having experiences simultaneously teach you how to become calm under that pressure is imperative. I think a lot of people, they tend to feel that they need to figure it out on their own first, and they need to try to create a foundation of self. Like I have to figure it out myself before then I can allow help in, or I can allow mentors in, or allow my experiences to be a little bit more bold. I think that's where people end up having more problems as they progress in life. At a young age, again, I was also semi-forced to accept the mentorship that I had. But I'm not going to complain because, I mean, at 9 years old, I got to hang out with Mickey Mantle, one of the legends in professional baseball in the sport. So I'm not complaining about the guys that I grew up around. I'm fortunate and I feel very blessed that I had that kind of family and those connections. But I learned by following their lead, watching guys like Nolan Ryan and all those different pitchers that I really emulated, is how they were able to stay focused on their breath, stay focused in the moment, and do what we always talk about. Everybody says one step at a time, but the reality is it's so true. One pitch at a time. And every time, what am I focusing on? I'm focusing on my catcher. I'm understanding the nature of my batter, who I'm pitching against, his skill sets, his power, his weaknesses. I've studied him based on the year in, year out progression. I know where to pitch, how to pitch, and I keep training on that on a daily basis. Off season, I'm at the cages. I'm pitching with my dad. I'm with the trainers that are teaching me. So I'm constantly in a space of discipline with relentless training to get myself to be able to be even more of a calm leader that people depend on. And it was uncomfortable. I mean, I was a young kid. I'm like 9 years old on a mound and I've got the entire team depending on me. But the reality is that is the position that holds the cohesiveness of the team together and the pace. We set the pace for the function of the team. When our pitcher is optimal, the team can function much better because that's the guy or the gal that sets the tone for the game's flow. So reality was it was basically being put in the fire, learning on the spot, like on the job training, while having those mentors outside of me kind of constantly redirecting my focus into my attention and my discipline, really supported my ability to evolve in that sport efficiently and be a really good pitcher where 13 years old, I was throwing 82 mile an hour fastball. So it's like that didn't come naturally. I didn't just pick up a ball and do that. Even though I had the foundational talent, it was developed through my willingness to open up and surrender to that leadership that was teaching me how to be a better leader. And that developed me into the type of baseball star that I wanted or hoped I could be.
So let's talk about something you said there that was really important. And I've been trying to illustrate this within our coaching community and our community at large, and that is breathing and how much you are in control. And when you can control breathing, you can control all scenarios within yourself. So at 9 years old, were you taught a breathing technique? Were you shown how to reset, or was this something that just came naturally?
I did. I started to do it naturally through dealing with certain dynamics in my family. So I having stress around, again, I have a very big family and very successful entrepreneurs, medical professionals, you know, things like that. So it's not like I grew up in an impoverished household. However, again, there's so many different big personalities. And I had to learn at a young age, being around family functions with 50, 60, 100 people at these things, quickly how to stay kind of like hidden and calm in the mess of the adults. Again, there was some traumas in the personal family directly with my mom and my dad as well that I had to really grow up and step up at a young age. At 6 years old, I was changing the diapers of my youngest brother. So I had to really be able to understand how to complete a task without overwhelming myself. So I think I naturally started to just focus on taking that deep breath and then going back in and executing on whatever I had to do. I didn't understand it. Again, it's not comprehension happening at that age, but it was just a thing I started to do. And then when I became older and started to really experience how that can help me in those stressful moments, I just realized, okay, this is a primary focus of mine. I need to keep breath as a tool, because I think we underutilize our natural God-given breath that we have in our bodies. We don't breathe deeply enough. We don't use that as an asset. And it just gave me so much more clarity mentally and emotionally when I could breathe. And I noticed, Kelsey, when I didn't breathe at all, I was panicked. I stressed out. I was angry. I started to get frustrated at things. I'd break my own stuff. So I had to learn the contrast quickly too, to go, hey, what happens when you don't?
Hey, humans. I know you've all been seeing me drink HVMN's Ketone IQ lately. This is a game changer. Jet fuel in a bottle. I use Ketone IQ for everything in my life, whether it's running, cycling, podcasting, or just the extra boost that my brain needs. I won't lie, it helps push me to the next level in all things. I love Ketone IQ and what HVMN stands for. Go grab some shots today at HVMN.com and use the code BRASS20 and save.
But what happens when you do?
Right.
And that changed everything for me.
Well, when you realize that you have this innate power to control your nervous system and bring it up or down,
right,
to really ramp yourself to, you know, getting ready to go do something really, really hard, all the way down to putting yourself into a, you know, a very calm, relaxed, meditative state, that's all within your power. But most people, I had this conversation with my mentor the other day, and she works with breath, and we were sitting there. She's like, you know, I want you to stick your hands under your diaphragm. And she's like, most people can't do that. Most people's diaphragms, they don't know how to utilize the tools that are our own breath. And it's really fascinating to hear that you were able to problem solve and work that yourself at a young age to not only lift yourself up in baseball, but then to be able to stay calm around these really, in my opinion, just freight train like animals that I'm so sorry. I don't understand. Like, I'm so okay. I'm gonna side tangent.
Let's
I
do it.
I don't understand people who were like, that thing weighs multiple thousand pounds and I'm gonna sit on it and get shit whipped stupid.
Yeah.
And then just like hope it doesn't step on me or put one of its giant horns through my body. I don't understand it.
I get it. I get it. It is it's an acquired taste. It's the same thing with most extreme sports. Like I'm a skydiver as well. So you either going to be good and like it or you're not. And it's such a black and white world. Bull riding is not something that you're innately drawn to. It is a rough stock world. It is a certain breed of people. I grew up, also my mom introduced me to country music at a young age. I have family members that live in the South. So it was kind of like little pieces of that were already in the element of my childhood. However, when I met that cowboy in high school, I thought it was so cool. You know, I'm a young kid, I'm 14 or whatever it was. And I thought that looks awesome. So I started watching some PBR stuff and I thought it was so wild and crazy. And I felt this draw. So it naturally just kind of called to me, give it a go. And I wanted to try it. And in Southern California, despite it being motocross central, of the United States, there are a lot of rodeo cowboys coming out of Southern California. So in Lake Elsinore, that's where I started to ride for the first time and went out there and got in the back of this. He was about 1600 pounds. So yeah, they're pretty decent sized bull. And he wasn't that ranked. He wasn't that progressive as an animal. Now these animals.
How tall were you? How big were you?
I'm at the time when I rode 16, I'm 6 foot, 180 pounds. So Okay. I'm 6'1", 205 right now. So if it gives you a little contrast at 44, the difference, but, you know, played high school football as well. So I was exercising and things like that. So I'm a pretty decent sized, you know, 16-year-old kid. But I remember getting on the back of this thing and feeling this world of excitement rush through me, and almost like the dizziness, the nerves, my heart beating through my chest, this live animal underneath me at 1600 pounds. These animals, Kelsey, are raised to buck. That's their job. That's what these people raise them to do. So when they get into these shoots, they know their job. But then we get out of the shoots, you can walk around the arena, hang out with them, put your hands on them, feed them, whatever it is. They won't mess with you. But it's interesting is getting on the back of that thing and have them tighten my rope. It's like I felt myself realize that I'm on the back of this live, living creature that when that gate opens is going to do whatever it wants to do. And I have to learn quickly in real time how to move my body with it based on what I crash course I got from these cowboys so that I can ride them for an 8-second period. And it is interesting is because they are their own unique personalities, their spirits. So they will do whatever. You might think they're going to come out and turn left. They might just turn right on you that day and just throw you for a loop. And I love that the idea when I shook my head to call my gate and that bull blew out of the gate. I mean, it wasn't like he was blowing PBR style, but he came out, lifted me up, slammed me down. I was holding as tight as I could for dear life with that rope, my legs squeezing against his body. 2.5 seconds later, I'm on the ground. It's kind of like rainy. He slips in the mud, falls on my left leg, creates a huge Charlie horse. He turns to get up off of my leg, stares at me for a split second with his eyes, and I'm bugging out like a crazy person on my hands and knees, thinking this thing's gonna kill me. This is it for me. But the reality was he was trying to get away from me as well. And when I got done, I sat there for a minute and I thought, do I like that? And I felt this feeling of yes, I feel alive. I feel free. And look, again, growing up as a Catholic, going to church, I prayed and I just was like, you know what? I get it. I have to let go of so much rigidity in my own mind and in my own heart. I have to start learning how to be more fluid. And I have to, it's literally, I'm having this like feeling in my body. And I remember going home and going, I want to do that again, and talking to my buddies who hooked it all up. So it just, that world drew me in. Okay. I felt like, again, it's a calling, I think. And I feel like not everybody's going to feel the same way. And that's, instead of like going, I don't get it, you're crazy, people go, I don't get it, but good for you, you know? And it's like, okay, same thing with skydiving. People go, you guys have death wishes. Like, no, we don't. We wouldn't wear two parachutes if we had a death wish.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, I'm going to jump off a building if I want to kill myself. So, it's just a seductive draw that really turned me on and allowed me to see a side of me that I didn't even know existed. And that's why I felt like putting yourself in environments that scare you and rattle you, hiring people, coaches such as yourself that aren't afraid to get dirty and gritty with you, that can get into the trend, that is equivalent to that world to me, where the work I do is the same thing. It's like out of your control, surrender, unconditional vulnerability, and learning literally about yourself with you when you have no control over the situation or the experience, and watch what you're capable of accomplishing because of it. And that's how I correlate those two events.
It's interesting too, because the bull riding community is it's a professional sport, right? So it's got all of the bells and whistles. I didn't understand too much about it until I had a gentleman on the show. Unfortunately, he has since passed, but Chris came on the show and he was the first African-American photographer. He was the only African-American photographer for the NBA for a very long time. He came from France and then he was with the PBR, and he has some absolutely insane photos from that time. And I got to tell you, when I was asking him about being around these animals and being this environment, it's this really beautiful symbiotic relationship with animals. Because I guess for me, I'm one of those people who's like, I'll eat the meat if it's from a regenerative farm and I know the animal hasn't been tortured to death.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then it's like with these events, these, what do you call those? Rallies, or what are they called?
Rodeos. Is that about the rodeos?
Yeah. When you go to these things, it's like, I'm always like, but the animals, but the poor animals. And I always wondered, and maybe this is a silly question, so bear with me here.
Sure.
These bulls, what is their life like when this is their job, when they're ranked? I'm assuming they're treated quite well they're a money-making animal, no?
Oh yeah. Oh, you want to look at this. If you go to the highest levels in the PBR right now and look at this rough stock that they have been raising and breeding, they are some of the most intense animals that has ever have ever been put into the circuit. I've been watching some of these guys riding that. I mean, there's one bull that had a 33 buck off streak. I mean, he was throwing every cowboy. Nobody could ride him. And these are some of the best riders in the world. They are born and bred to do one job, and that is to produce. This whole entire experience for those cowboys to ride for the event, for the sport. When they are out of the chutes, when they're not being used for the sport, they're fed well, they're raised well, they're taken care of. I mean, you want to talk about free range, they're allowed to just be animals. Nobody abuses them or hurts them. If they are, I better not see it. But at the same time, it's like, I've watched some of these guys that raise these animals in Southern California, and the way they love them and care for them and give them everything. They're just designed and created where then once they're put into that environment, oh, my job now is to buck this cowboy off. But when I'm out of it, I walked around in arenas before a rodeo. There was a rodeo I went to, I entered in to ride. And I remember walking around the arena with the entire stock that they were going to use for the show. The night before, we were drinking beer and we were having a good time. And it was like hanging out with these animals. We're getting a little buzz, playing with them. And they were just walking around us like they were grazing with us, like it was nothing in the arena. So the reality is they don't hurt them. Now, they do something in the chute. They put what's called a flank strap on at the back end. It's kind of like the area of your bladder in your body. And
yeah, I wondered about that.
So they create pressure in that so that the animal wants to kick even harder to get that off.
Perfect.
So that's part of it as well. And then your rope is up around their breast area, their chest. Right. So your rope is tied around that too. So I get it. You're an animal. You're in this tight, confined space. You got this thing on the back of you, and you got these two ropes pressing your entire body. Yeah. I'd want that off me too. However, I think it's just all designed that way. So again, the reality is they take very good care of them. And yes, they are money-making machines. They are definitely money. It's a business. So,
Yeah, I never thought they were you weigh nothing compared to that doesn't bother them. It's always that post, you know, what if it doesn't buck well? What if it stops being the money perform? You know, I always question those things, but that's because I'm soft. It's fine.
No, it's all right. I'm with you. I'm a softy too. I like animals, dogs especially. I cannot stand human beings hurting any animal whatsoever. It boils my blood to the point where it's like the world is very fortunate, some of us, that we can't do certain things legally. So I would just say that, leave my peace anymore. Back in our, you know, in the late 90s and 2000s, it's kind of got away with a little bit more. But nowadays, I get you. I feel you because I'm very much an emotional guy. I get it. I love animals of all kinds. I think they should be cared for and respected. We're given them to take care of them as stewards, not to be abusers. So again, that's, I bleed with you on that aspect.
Yeah, it's an interesting, it's an interesting process watching the rodeos kind of evolve and change and what that's like for bull riders. And I want to talk about something that most people have heard me discuss before, which are TBIs. There's something near and dear to me. I have one. My husband has one. Everyone I know has one. I want to understand how you go from football, which most Americans play, which up here we don't as much. You go from, we're more like hockey people, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm not, but they go from football to then baseball. So you've got this innate talent, this incredible shoulder and arm, which most people, doesn't matter how hard you train it, you're not whipping a ball at 80 miles an hour. It's just not happening. Mm-hmm. You've got this arm, which I'm assuming is going to be the dominant arm to hang on to the bull, which is going to potentially tear everything that you've just worked for. And once you injure this, you're never coming back fully. I don't care what anybody says. I know that life. So how do you then go? I know your parents said, we don't want to ride bull. We don't want you doing this. So how do you then go from, I'm not going to play baseball, I've got this opportunity to be a pro athlete, I've got this opportunity to do something different, to I'm going to destroy myself even more on a bull?
I still played baseball while I was doing that.
Wow.
Now, here's the thing. I'm left-hand dominant, but I'm semi-ambidextrous. So I bat both ways, but I only pitch with my right arm. So
probably not say that on podcast because that's a great clip.
I write with my left hand as well. So when I pitch with my right arm.
Okay.
But when I rode, I roll with my left hand.
Mm, smart.
But I could switch. There were days where I felt like stronger with my left hand being dominant, more balancing that way, because the opposite arm in the bull riding world is your part of your balance. You learn how to stabilize your body utilizing your single arm as the grip. Bull riding is majority of, like, 80% of its legs as well. So you have to learn how to use your legs from your ankles up into your thighs. Yeah, squeeze. When the bull jumps, We call that posting, where you squeeze and lift your butt up off the bowl a couple inches. So you kind of ride with him as he's leaping up in the air. And when he comes down, you kind of find yourself sitting a little bit back more down on him to kind of absorb that shock of him in the ground. And as he turns, you know, it's fluid. So you're learning how to lean into the turn preemptively before he actually creates the full turn, just like motorcycle riding. You learn to look where you're going to go. So it just becomes a nice fluid dynamic. So I didn't hurt myself. And at the same time, my dad had physical therapists and things like that were working with my pitching arm. So was always warmed up. I was always massaged. My arm was always taken care of. And when I go train, the coaches made sure they iced me afterwards. So it was never an issue. Now, as I got towards military service in high school, when I joined the Army Reserves first to get some experience before active duty, I started to notice that my arm started to feel more sore because I was doing both. And I started to have to do extra PT to take care of it. And that's where I realized, okay, what do I want to do? Okay, can I do both of these simultaneously for long periods of time? Probably not. So make the decision. And that's where I think towards the end of high school, before I went active duty, I kind of stopped playing baseball altogether, strictly stuck to bull riding. And then the military was just like waiting for me to graduate so that I can leave and get out of there. So that's how I came to terms with those two worlds clashing together.
Got it. So you worked with the 101st, which I know those guys. They were at our FOB. They're a solid group of human beings. So
I was a Rakusan with the 187 Infantry Regiment. So mortars. I was a specialized in mortar gun system. So I was 11 Charlie.
Again, so you have head injury after head injury after head injury. Fantastic.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my God. It blows my mind that you can formulate a sentence still. So let's get into, so you did 5 years of service. You did three combat tours, Afghan, Iraq. What was your deal and what year?
Kosovo, Afghanistan and Iraq. So, 2000, all of 2000, I was in Kosovo. I was 20 years old at the time. And that's where I had my first experience with armed combatants. We were on a specific operations that they said, again, it was peacekeeping, humanitarian aid. However, you know how it all works. It's like, hey, we need teams of guys to go in and do certain things, X, Y, Z. So I partook on some really cool operations as a young guy. And I got to have some really real world experiences with international incidents and capturing combatants and things like that. So Kosovo was great. I came home, I re-enlisted, I got my EIB, which is your expert infantryman's badge. It was another big thing for the infantry for us to have that. Re-enlisted and trained some more. And I was getting prepped to go to Ranger school. And then September 11th happened. So Afghanistan was obviously our next calling. So nobody got to go schools anymore after that. It was just like hey, sorry about it. We're going to promote you, but we can't send you to Ranger school, which pissed me off because I wanted to go get into 75th Ranger Regiment where my brother was. My brother was a Ranger. So to me, my lifelong dream being in the Army was to be a 75th Special Operations. So that just gave me a bad taste in my mouth about the Army. I was like, okay, here's what we call is a big green weenie, kind of doing it again, screwing us again. I'm just going to suck it up and deal with it because I love being in the infantry. I love doing this job. I'm going to go overseas and do my duty. And I came home, had crazy times in Afghanistan. We were all over Bagram, Kandahar. We did Operation Anaconda in the Shaikot Valley and things like that. So it was wicked. It was wicked to be involved in combat operations like that and have those experiences and know why we did what we did and trained for. And then Iraq happened. And halfway through my Iraq tour is when I got asked to re-enlist again. And that's when I was like, I don't trust you. You know, like but when I told Andy this too, and I said, look, I told my first sergeant, I want Ranger school. He's like, we're promoting E5. I want Ranger school and I want airborne school. Cause they guys screwed me out of my airborne slot when I was in boot camp. They're like, we can get it for you, but command wants you to give 6 more years first. And I was like, well, it's insane. That's a lot of time to ask me for. Yeah. So, but yeah, that's what I did. I was a light infantry guy. I did a lot of operations overseas with Canadian forces. You know, we did a lot of joint operation tactics with your infantry and artillery. We did stuff with SEAL teams and Green Berets. It was fun to really have those unique experiences. Even though I wasn't in the special operations community, I got to work with them and experience in some of those, you know, different types of procedures and operations that they got to do firsthand, which was really cool. It's a memory I'll never forget.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting to watch. I always loved running the guns because the 101st would just sit there and watch. They just found it so fascinating. They're like, pull the lanyard. They're going to pull it. It's on repeat. Relax.
Relax.
But it was an amazing experience, like you said, getting to do those jobs. So it sounds like you had a leadership skills that were built into that really transitioned well into service. And it seems like you were just, in my opinion, not that, you know, 20, 25 year people, it's not that you're not worth for more, but it sounds like you had a different plan. You had a different perspective. You did your time, you did your duty and service. but it seemed like you were on a different path than maybe your brothers were. And that is just maybe
That's
what
it.
it's supposed to be, right?
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah.
So let's get into how you got into the Radical Performance Acceleration Program. I mean, you've been doing that now. It says you've got over 14 years.
Yep.
I gotta tell everyone your bio. I text you this after because I was like, dude, your bio's so intense. I read it, and as I was reading it, I was getting more amped up, like paragraph by paragraph. And by the time I got to the point where it's like, he pushes the elite beyond the perceived limits, so they're not only hit their peak in all areas of life, but they can sustain it. And then you dropped into the next one, and he's like, the secret weapon. I was like, oh! And then he gets to the next one. It's intimate and intense and unconventional transactional self-help therapy. And I was like, oh my God, this guy's bio fucks. So I need to understand how you constantly just leveled yourself up. Obviously, had the experience.
Yeah.
But how do you go, I want to start working with some of the elite people that aren't SF. I want to start working with maybe civilians who don't understand leadership concepts. They don't understand themselves, their own self-worth. Where do you go and how do you start that?
I had no idea. That's awesome. The utter truth. It's nothing that I have created, nothing, even that bio. That is the help of people that can see the work that I do being so unconventional and different, trying to distill down what I do into a bio format, a website, you know, different types of like social media stuff. I had no idea at the beginning. The reality was, going back to our initial conversation, was I was different, and I was different for a reason. And God built me the way he did for a reason. I erupt. My spirit does, it exposes people's deepest, ugliest truths that they tend to hide and hold onto. Humans can't hold it back when I'm in their space with them. So that's a natural gift that we built the business technically around it. I started working with combat veterans. So that's really what it came down to, is like, I didn't know where I was going to go. When I first got out of the military, I pursued firefighting. I was going to be a firefighter.
Really?
That's what I wanted to do with lifelong childhood dream. I was a little boy. I had pictures of me hanging off fire trucks as a kid. It was all about service. I love taking care of people. I was all about animals and others, homeless people. So firefighting felt like the next best step. Being in a light infantry unit, being a squad leader of the 60 mortar section when I got out, taking my guys to Iraq, coming home, going, you know what, next best step, firefighting, right? Be on a team, go work with other guys, service to the community. It's interesting is you don't know who you're going to meet. And I think a lot of the times people pass opportunities that are ideal for them because it doesn't show up in the perfect package that they expect it to be. It might not sound the way you typically like things to sound. It might not look the way you want it to look, or you might not feel totally good or comfortable with it. And then you go, well, my guts tell me that this is not the right time or opportunity, but maybe your gut's wrong because you're still dealing with so much trauma and stress yourself that you can't discern when a good thing is showing up in your life. And I think at that point, when I met my business partner, she was like, look, I gotta straight up tell you, I can feel you. I see who you really are. You're supposed to be healing men. You're supposed to be helping men. This is what I feel you're supposed to do. She left that seed, and that was it. There was no pushing me to do anything. And it was interesting is like a week later, a veteran I knew walked up and goes, hey, I want to coach with you. I watch how you walk around, how you carry yourself. Teach me how to be confident. Show me what it means to feel free. He goes, you went to war like I did. He goes, but I don't, he goes, there's a contrast here. And I thought, how interesting that that guy approached me to coach him. I was like, coach, what the hell is coaching? Like, I'm not going to do that. It's not kind of exciting for me. I was also pissed because in the VA, I had conversation after conversation after conversation with psychiatrists and psychologists who were trying to tell me how broken I was. I'm not broken. Okay. If anything, you're pissing me off. You're going to make me even more broken right now because you don't even know what you're talking about. And they were judging you, and like, well, you know what? I did my rating stuff for them. They're like, you know, did you kill anybody? Did you see dead bodies? Did you see all
none
this
of
stuff
your
they
business.
Do? That it's like, why do I have to answer this? You want to know something? Here's the thing. I can tell you right now, I have anger and frustration being post-military, more so from the transition than from the combat itself. Can we just identify that? Maybe we can discuss that. But Kelsey, in that process, this is leading to my point about the business, is I started to look at where people were limiting themselves by only utilizing things like talk therapy as their outlet, or hiring guys like Tony Robbins in the big self-help guru world, where they don't actually care about what's really plaguing you in a very intimate setting or dynamic. They want you to buy into their programs that they have created in a more systematic cookie cutter approach towards human growth. That's mm-hmm. why a small percentage of people can actually apply that to their lives, and the rest of the people are never ending hamster wheel, spending more time and money in the personal development space and never getting out of that hell loop. And for me, I went, something's wrong here. There's blind spots all up in this business. I don't want to work with people like that. Mm. And as I started working with these veterans, the veterans that I knew were like, hey, I have a vet buddy of mine who's suffering TBI. Can you do some stuff with him? So I was working with guys who were blown up by IEDs. I was working with former team guys. I was working with, you know, a MARSOC dudes, JSOC guys that were just showing up because of my relationships and going out and meeting veterans at events with IAVA or all over the, wherever I could find myself just showing up and shaking hands, just became a natural business thing that just grew where veterans were showing up and I was letting them stay with me. We were spending days in, you know, weekends together. I was letting them live with me for a few days at a time, helping them battle those personal demons because as a veteran, they understood I get them. So there was this intimate dynamic. And then on top of that, I was bringing in certain doctors that I had met over the years. Hey, I need you to come in here and help this person push through this limit here. I can't, I'm not a doctor. So they were like, yeah, Wiley, no problem. We'll help you out there. And we would do it together in like this really intimate relationship. Long story short, that just naturally birthed into, hey, Wiley, I got friends of mine that are professionals, doctors, real estate guys. They want to know what you did for me. You know, I worked with a dude who was a former MARSOC guy and he three IEDs. I mean, the guy's completely blown to smithereens. His wife said he basically was like raising her third child. I mean, he was just completely messed up. And after we had worked together, he was sleeping better at night. He was off his medication to sleep. His wife said he actually was having better conversations with her. His outbursts were actually few and far between now. She's like, I don't know what you did or how you did it. However, it doesn't matter. What matters is the result. We have a friend of ours that plays pro baseball and he wants to know what you did for so-and-so. Would you be willing to talk to him? He wants to see how you can help his life. And it just naturally referred into these worlds of higher performing people that say, hey, I've spent the money and time with personal development people and they've done nothing for me. What are you doing? Hey, I'm working with this guy. He's a combat vet. This is what he does. He's different. He doesn't coach you. He actually confronts you and he fights you and he makes you face things in real time. Like it doesn't matter. You actually have no say in what he tells you to do, but it creates sustainable, optimal results and it gives the freedom and the peace that you're longing for. And consequently, the money and the opportunities, they just show up because they're already capable of doing that on their own. It's not like I'm, hey, if you want to work with me, I'm going to make you $1 million and I'm going to help you. You know, I optimize human beings. It's all about the intimate relationship. So I didn't know I was going to work with higher caliber people. However, because of what results I was creating in the capacity that I have, it naturally became synergistic that the people with the biggest capacities could handle the level of intensity that I put people through in the relationship I have with individuals. I've tried to work with your average person. It doesn't work. They break, they fall. The first challenge I make them go through, they run away from me. They're like, I can't do it. And that's okay. So these people at this higher level, the leaders, we realized if we can impact those people, the masses, then naturally we'll be better for it. That's the person that has the impact on the millions, if we their lives, right? Yeah. Guess what happens to the millions of people that emulate or respect them? They naturally want to get better. It's just an innate part of human dynamics. So it just became this thing of like behind the scenes where I was being asked to go to parties. I was coming to an event. Say, Wiley, you come to my mastermind. I want you to meet someone. Sure, no problem. And I travel on my dime and I go out there. I had no expectation of getting clients. I just showed up to be me. And it was just that essence where I'd walk across conferences and I'd have guys go, who the fuck do you think you are? And I'm going, oh, here we go. And they're like, I don't even know why I said that bitch. To you. And they go, I don't even know why I said that to you. You remind me of my dad. And for some reason I saw that and I just wanted to, and I said, okay, let's go break some bread. And next thing you know, that guy became a client and it's just intimate dynamic where it's why it's so unconventional. It's why even you read in that bio, I'm like, that was all clients calling me that. And the clients call me a performance accelerator. Clients say proverbial Navy SEAL training equivalent because I work with guys that were in that community. It's just saying what I do is intense. It's unconventional. It's unorthodox. It's not coaching. It's hard for people to comprehend in their mind. I really just have relationships with people and say things and do things that nobody else will to really break through the strongholds that are limiting their lives. And I mean, I live with the people. I travel with them 24/7, upwards of a year. I only work with 2 to 3 people a year max. It's very intimate. And it's all about truly getting involved in their lives with them, seeing where everything is hindering who they are. I don't need to teach a billionaire how to make $1 billion, but I can assure you that that billionaire's life will be completely different. His relationships will be better. His health, his peace, his satisfaction, we night and day, so that he can turn around and do better things with $1 billion that he makes. So that's really what the nature of my work comes. So Radical Performance Acceleration just was like a, how do we identify this? How do we throw it together? Well, we are accelerating people. I'm breaking down strongholds. I'm healing and creating transformation inside this human being so that they have better impact in the world. It's happening radically to the point where I've had therapists literally go, you should be saying things like that to people. I'm like, I don't care. I'm going to say whatever I want because this is getting results that you couldn't get. So at the end of the day, it's transcending typical self-help talk therapy. And it's really getting to the nitty gritty and the nooks and crannies of an individual's life, breaking down the dynamics that are hindering and hurting that person that they otherwise can't see on their own. And it does take a very special type of person who can feel me and go, you know what? I want to explore a little bit more with you rather than try to think, you know, well, you don't sound like a coach. So why would I hire you? It's like, well, then you're not the person who's going to work with me because you can't even let go to surrender, like as a bull rider, to realize that I'm just a different breed. And if you can open yourself up, set your ego down, then we can accomplish great things together. If not, no big deal. I'll keep moving forward.
See, I like something that you just said there. You said, set your ego down, not kill your ego. So there's this thing, this concept I want to talk to you about because it's something that I see in the psychedelic space as an integration coach and then with regular clients. And there's this ego mindset. Well, my ego needs to be killed in order for me to be successful. Well, I'm like, no. You need to sit down and have a conversation with your ego and put that thing in the back seat. That's my opinion, is I believe that it could still exist, but there's a way for you to work with it, not against it. And I hear a lot of individuals, and I know you have as well, because they're all in our space, but you hear people, I need to outrun my demons. I need to kill my ego. I need to kill my, no. Because the second that you don't have the ability to continue to run, guess what catches up with you?
Your demons. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I love that. Here's the thing. Our ego is part of us. It is the sense of self. The idea is, I heard a talk last night, and I'm trying to remember what he said specifically right now on the spot here, but it was talking about, so right now it's like, I fast, you know, fasting is a part of sacrifice. It's part of giving something up. Especially in my faith, it's called Lent. So in Lent, we sacrifice, we give up something, especially that what we hold near and dear to us. It's almost like we're limiting ourselves for something that we typically hold on to really tightly. Mm-hmm. Well, the ego, it does that. The ego wants to hold on to things. However, if you learn how to create harmony within yourself, you have, like I said, we work with the right people, you use the right medicinals, you use different things that are in the right balance. The ego's not going to go anywhere. You need it. That's what gives us that sense of understanding ourselves. There's a difference between, in psychology, they talk about primary and secondary narcissism. Primary is actually the good part of it, where you go, you know what, I am worthy enough. I do feel that I have something of value, or it's a general, decent, humble sense of self. And then you have the secondary, which is what your malignant narcissist, the ones that are like prideful, you know, they're the best in the world. They know everything. Nobody's better than them. That's trauma. That's a damage up there. So that's the ego, which is in two different facets. So you can't kill your ego. You can learn how to surrender and set it down so that it doesn't actually hinder you or cause you to miss opportunities or create problems. The other thing too is your demons, you can't outrun them. They're always going to be there until you're willing to face them. So the reality is, it's not about killing the demon, because the truth is, it's about breaking down the strongholds that allow them to exist within you in the first place. Mm. And I think people are too busy trying to cart before the horse, or they're trying to approach problem solving from an outside in rather than an inside out. And they think the symptom of the demon, I have to kill the symptom. And it's cliche, but it's the truth. I have to kill the symptom rather than going, no, what is the stronghold that it gave that demon permission? And I'm talking colloquial speaking as well. I'm not just necessarily speaking spiritually, but what is causing the stress that I'm carrying to stay there and not be eradicated? Mm-hmm. Because there's a difference between good stress and bad stress. You can eradicate bad stress. You learn how to manage good stress as an asset for performance, and you can kill bad stress, but you have to start with the strongholds. And that starts with your ability to surrender and be pushed and stretched in a way that is very uncomfortable for you, that you can't control, and that you can't understand what is coming with it. It's like a lot of the clients I work with, they don't know what's coming. You know what happens is I get the real them. I get the true them. I get the rawest, nastiest, real version of that human being because they have no idea what I'm going to do. They have no idea how it's going to show up, what it's going to feel like. And that gets that raw, real vulnerability open. So that's where I can get the capacity stretch and I can actually face and see the strongholds and put them in a challenging situation that then can eradicate that stress that's plaguing them. So I think we look at it this way, is like, stop trying to kill the symptom, start getting to the root cause. But the root cause is very scary for human beings. Most human, even military guys, they're like, nah, I'm good. Nah, I'm good. Suck it up. And I heard someone saying on X, recruit, you know, don't try to kill your demons, recruit them. And I was like, and anybody that says that, don't listen to them. Don't follow them, because that means their demons are dictating what they're saying. And that's not somebody you want to emulate. Do right. not recruit your demons. They're already the reason why you're not living the life you really want. So,
right. Yeah. They're holding you back. It's an interesting concept, the kill your demons ones. I know it's been made quite famous by a lot of different people utilizing it as like a tool. And I think that, you know, every time I go to say something along those lines, I get the visual picture of it. So I have this visualization of the ego on a chain that's sitting while I eat my ice cream cone and deciding that it's going to be there. And that's fine. You be there and we'll have chats, but you don't get to play until I say you get to play. And it's not about trying to control these huge subsets of ourselves. It's about trying to understand where they came from. And I love that you say that, because so often, so frequently, whether it's military, whether it's first responder, whether it's individuals in life now, we are so quickly prescribed a medication to deal with a symptom, and we are never taught to deal with the problem. And the other thing that I find really, really fascinating about the way that you discuss things, which is very different than a lot of coaches, is when you're looking at the root problem, you don't need to be a psychiatrist to diagnose the root problem. You can just be somebody with perspective. And that's why coaches work really well with people, because you're able to see and give the perspective that the person is so head down in, they cannot see where it's coming from.
Yeah. You need an outside force. You truly do. I mean, it goes to physics, Newton's law of physics. An object that's in motion will stay in motion until an outside force is enacted upon it and redirects it. We think about human beings. The truth is, most people that climb this ladder of success, a lot of the leaders we have, look at our politicians. I mean, these are a perfect example. They have nothing but yes men around them. Can you imagine having someone who is unafraid of their personality, their status, their money, and is willing to get into their ass, so to speak, and really make them face the truth about who they are and why they're operating or acting the way they are in public? That fact is, we end up then chalking it all up as, well, that's just the cost of being human. You know, I've heard people say, well, Wiley, who are you to say that so-and-so, because they, you know, look what they created for society. So what? We all have trauma. It's like, that's kind of a cop-out. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Give me a break. Because here's the thing. Imagine if that individual was optimized. Imagine if that individual faced their demons and actually healed the trauma of being bullied as a kid or being abused by their parent. Imagine if they did something real to really radically transform themselves from the inside. How much more could they be doing and creating, given their status and their capacity? Mm-hmm. And I challenge that notion, because we have everybody just saying, you know what? It's okay if they're a complete screw up on social media. Look at the cool things they built for us. It's like, is that really the benchmark we want to leave for our generations behind us and say, these are the standards we're setting for you? And the reality is, it's like, I'm not liked because I challenge that. And a lot of people don't want to work with me because I do that kind of stuff. They want the person that makes them have a semblance of control. I've met public figures that are like, yeah, they can't let go of control. They have to control their resources, because they have these empires that they have built on the chaos that they have endured their entire life. And I'm not a yes man. I don't care who you are. I really don't settle for that. And I will go in places that other people won't go, because I can see the truth about who you really are and what's affecting you. And if you don't like that, that's okay. And I think we need more people that are willing to do that. And that drives me nuts, because I see the leaders that we have in these positions, like we were talking about before offline with Made in Canada and how these people are making these decisions and medical. And what are we doing? You know why? It's because nobody's battling their crap. Nobody's making them face truth. It's we're projection. Just allowing them to be. Yep.
Yeah. It's a projection of what they feel is comfortable. You know, you have this group called Dying with Dignity, and I'm doing some really nasty diving on them right now that they're just not consciously aware of. When you have over $7.6 to $7.8 million every single year sitting in a fund, I want to know where it's coming from.
Sure.
I want to know. And so when you have people that are pushing rape victims and other individuals to kill themselves rather than to get help and get support, and they're doing it at a pace that's really gross, you have to take a look at where it's coming from and who is who is pushing these ideas? And when you look in behind the curtain and when you see, and this isn't a judgment as to who they look like, but this gives you a good indication. People who are morbidly obese, who are unhealthy, who don't love themselves, who are telling everybody else to go kill themselves. It's just a reflection of them. And they're just the world is just the mirror to them. And it's very obvious perception. And so I love that you're able to look at these different individuals and give them something that nobody else is willing to give them, and you're able to say to them, you don't have to be this way, and we can fix this using a whole different healing modality.
Absolutely. And that's the thing, is I have specialists across the entire field of human performance. If I need medicinals, guess who I call? My specialists, who are medical doctors or, you know, naturopathic doctors. I bring my resources to the table with my clients. So I'm creating a holistic new relationship. And one of the things that the other people do is I experience, feel, and go through the trauma, the pain, and the rage, or whatever they're going through with them. So I become served technically as a pseudo or de facto
conduit
thing that broke them. And it's not, I'm not doing that on purpose. I don't go, hey, today I'm going to be the guy that raped you. It's not what's going to happen. However, I naturally am that because of my makeup, and they see that, and it gives them a place to fight it. It gives them a place to battle up against it. And we do it together. And I'm willing to sacrifice and go through the pain with them because I want that human being to be optimal. It's not about how much money I can make off the person. It's not about creating a program that I could put people through a pipeline just to create this, like, you know, conveyor belt of clientele. Everything that I do is individualized to the person in their unique situation. It's not cookie cutters. That's why when I've had calls, they're like, explain to me what you do. I can't do that. You have to learn how to let go of that notion, that limited notion of thinking things, and actually get into the space of what you're saying sounds right. What you are saying feels right, it or not. And making a decision based on that changes your life, because I think people make too many decisions based off of what they think and not enough on based on the almost like this intimate connection they're having with the individual. It's kind of like, I think you'll like this. Resumes blow my mind, okay? You can have a guy who's gold on resume, but a complete nightmare in person. Are you going to hire that person based off his paper, or do you want to meet that person and connect with that individual? Mm-hmm. See what happens in that intimate moment. And unfortunately, in a world of money drives everything. Most people start businesses, they're thinking more about how do I make a good living than how do I actually uphold to certain standards and be willing to sacrifice income for the sake of the mission that I say that I'm about when I create a coaching business or a product or a program. So to me, it's like, this is my life. When I work, I give my life. That's it. So it's about prioritizing yourself and getting to a place of realizing if you're doing what you're doing for money, that's okay. Just know it and don't try to be anything more than that. But if you really have a mission, be willing to face rejection in a way you've never experienced. Be uncomfortable in a way you've never experienced. Have people basically tell you you're horrible. You don't know what you're talking about. You sound stupid. All the things that can come from it. If you're willing to embrace that, you can actually do a lot more good for people. And that's where I think getting people to stop projecting starts with unfucking leaders. Mm-hmm. It really does. We have to get more people into that space to confront them and do really radical stuff. If it's not going to happen, then we won't change anything. And I think that's the sad thing that we're experiencing right now.
No, you're not wrong. You nailed it. Like, you absolutely nailed that. And I think that's a great way to kind of wind down here. When you're working with these people, how do people contact you? How do people even apply to be a client?
Well, there's no application process. It's really an introduction. It comes down to everything has been third party introduction, Kelsey. It really is. I'm not even expecting my website and the things that we put together since the pandemic to even convert anything, because the reality is not designed to convert. I don't want it to. I'd rather someone going, hey, I heard you here. I talked to someone that said they know you, and I just want to have a conversation with you. And then if that leads into an ongoing relationship from there, it naturally then unfolds into whether or not somebody might be a potential client. That's why it's so uniquely different, is there's no application. It's really a calibration. So when I meet someone, let's say you and I we're close, right? We're friends. You're like, hey, I got this guy. I told him what you do. He wants to sit down and meet with you. And I break bread with that individual, or have a cup of coffee or a glass of whiskey or whatever it is. And he's like, you know what? I really want to keep this going. That's literally how it works.
Right.
And it's like, great. And I'll spend time with that person for indefinite amount of time, depending on where they're at. I've spent weeks with an individual who's become a client, and I've spent upwards of it was 8 months with a public figure I worked with before he became a client. So it is truly about relationship dynamics and being in the right space with the right person who is willing and able to handle what will or will not happen when they commit to that dynamic. And when it's time for us to work together, it's literally they write a check. We just keep moving forward. There's no contract. There's no promissory note. It's a privacy thing. So I've worked with celebrities and pro athletes where confidentiality, privacy is utmost importance to not only me, but to them because of the nature of the work. So I will never reveal who I've worked with. I've passed up on opportunities with like Rolling Stone, Vanity Fair, and all these things because I won't divulge to them who my clients are out of respect for the nature of what we're doing. And that's just a standard I'd herald. So it's really about, do people feel it? Can people lean in and can we have a conversation? And if it explodes from there, fantastic. If not, then I'll keep moving forward, you know?
I love that. I love that. That green lit. That's how everything works. It goes back to the military mentality of if somebody green lights you, it's over. Everybody else, there's nothing anybody can do. You've been green lit by the right guy. That's all it takes. And that's the truth.
Yeah, it is the truth. That's why it's like certain people are like, well, if you get on these podcasts, you never know. I'm like, yeah, I'm not really going to hold my breath. I'm not. Right. Nobody, number two, it's a high investment to work with me. So at the end of the day, nobody is going to call me from a podcast and go, hey, I'm a CEO of a multi-billion dollar company and I want to hire you right now. It doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. But I am making relationships and having connections where if somebody goes, wow, I really want you to be around, then great. I'll show up on my dime. I'll sacrifice and I'll make time. I'll do things that I need to, because this work is not work. It's a mission. It's really about using my God-given gift to do what he built me for. And again, I'm not going to be popular, but at the same time, if I can help one person a year, then I've done my job.
It's purpose. It's purpose driven. That's all that matters. Yep,
absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, where do people follow you and at least support you and find out a little bit about you?
I'm having some good times on X. So at Wiley McGraw there, meet some cool people, have some great conversations, people like you as well. At Wiley, WileyMcGraw.com is the website we put together. It's got all the insights and philosophies. I wrote a couple white papers based on my experiences with leaders and executives and CEOs and stuff like that to understand performance, why you need to get unfucked, and all those different elements of what it takes to be an optimized human being so that you can break away from the molds of the conventional warfare that personal development has pulled people into. So those are the two places. I don't really have any other social media outlets. I'm trying to think if I do. I don't. I think it's X and my website. And from there, it's really where people want to connect, have a conversation. More than happy to pick up the phone.
I know you are. And that's what I was saying to you at the beginning. For people who want to understand what it's like to be around high level people, when people pick up the phone and start making phone calls before they even meet you, that's how you know they are a good person. Wiley is that, and he has done it, and he has been an example to me of what it means to have people around you who don't want anything from you but just want to see you thrive. And so I've been super grateful for that experience with you, and really, really grateful for our listeners that you've given us your time. But we are scheduling to have you back on towards the mid end of the year.
Awesome.
So I will make sure to gather amazing amounts of questions, I know, in self-help areas that are non-traditional, because I know people are going to have a million questions after this episode. But in saying that, thank you so much for being here. We'll put everything in the show notes and anything else anybody needs to know.
Right now, I'm just happy to be here. I'm really glad we got to connect and do this. I'm looking forward to round two. I think we're going to go a little bit deeper. It'll be even better.
Yeah, it will. Trust me, it will. And thanks for sorting out and letting my mouth heal last week. And reschedule.
Oh, of course. Of course.
Dude, it was bad news bears.
I understand that intimately. So when you said that, I thought, for me, I'm flexible. I'm happy to accommodate. So I'm glad you're good. Yeah,
I'm great now, man. Thank you so much. You stick with me. Everyone else, that's Wiley McGraw. We'll see y'all next week.